Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And indeed, we heard on the news there, it's a big day in Skibbereen today. Good morning to everybody in Skibbereen. And you know what? There was a book years ago called In Search of Excellence, and it was like, how do we find excellence in everything? There should be management consultants all down in Skibbereen figuring out what's going on in Skibbereen and how do we take that excellence and apply it across everything. And speaking of excellence, my panel are here poised, but A lot of excellence across the front pages of the papers today. Two-thirds back FFFG coalition for second term, according to a poll in the Sunday Independent. Banks ready to go to war with office owners as values plummet is the front of the Business Post. And you might be thinking, well, I don't care about the price of commercial property going down. I don't own a big commercial property building. But you know what you'll find? Your pension fund probably does. So that could affect all of us. And there's startling drops there. The bottom of the front of the Business Post is... Remember, there used to be this trope years ago about Michael O'Leary should be put in charge of the health service and Michael O'Leary should be put in charge of this, that and the other. Former Ryanair executive set to join HSE board in bid to drive productivity is the story here. And Michael Cawley, former deputy head of Ryanair, is set to join the board of the HSE, they say, in an effort to drive productivity across Ireland's health system. The Business Post understands this. So that will... It's a bold move, I think, to associate the name Ryanair with our health service. And already you can see people start talking about the Ryanairization of the health service, etc., etc. The Sunday Times, Sinn Féin vows to rip up system for house building. So they're going to basically strip down the Land Development Agency, it seems, and take away a lot of its staff and its powers and give that to local councils. And I think their full housing plan is coming out next week, possibly tomorrow. The Irish Mail on Sunday has a childcare story, and it's Marie Sherlock, the senator, giving out about sharp practice in the childcare sector. And the Sun and the Mirror both leading with what the Sun calls Irish fans' fury at Oasis tickets costs. Moaning Glory is their headline. Bots the Story is the headline on the Mirror. Fans' fury at Croke Park tickets website chaos as prices surge to €415. So we will come to all that and more with our panel. Aisling Meehan is an agricultural solicitor, a tax advisor and a farmer. Graham Finlay is a lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Pat Leahy is political editor with the Irish Times. And Suzanne Rogers is a research and policy analyst for Social Justice Ireland. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Brendan.
Pat Leahy, there's a lot of stories across the papers today about kind of what you might call the fragmenting of the government, jockeying for position on various policies and to take responsibility for various things, all kinds of throwing shapes and everything. It would strike you, this government obviously has one important job to do now, which is a budget. That aside, is this now, we're now at the start of the political season proper, is this now a zombie government where there's basically going to be, apart from the budget, it's play acting now about parties asserting identity, taking responsibility for stuff? People will get very tired of this if this goes on for the next 6 months or more, won't they?
Well, they may well do, but those of us whose job it is to write about it on a daily basis are relishing the prospect, I can assure you. So
yeah,
please,
yeah. Nothing like a zombie government fighting with itself.
Let's get our priorities in order. So I think if you asked people within the government what they have left to do, I don't think they would say, as you said, that they have one job, that is the budget. I think they would say they have two jobs. One, the budget. And secondly, to get re-elected. And I think that is the story of the remaining months of this government. And
so you see this phony war now for the next however long.
So I think what you'll see is a more publicly scrappy budget process than we have seen in recent years. And people will have seen, and there's some of it in today's papers, but they'll have seen in recent weeks. jockeying between the government parties to claim credit over things and on policy issues. And I think what you will see over the coming weeks is you'll see more of that happening in public. So that row over the vacant land tax between the Greens and Fianna Fáil, to my eye, what was significant about that was not so much that it was happening. These sort of rows happen all the time in a coalition government. It's what you expect over policy issues that the parties have differences on. But what was significant, as I say, to my eye, was the fact that both parties were content to do it in public. So budgets
what
are always...
What was significant as well was that then it was suddenly like over and we weren't sure who won or anything. And they came to the kind of normal compromise you would have thought anyway, which is we'll keep the farmers out of it, but it goes ahead anyway.
We'll have some sort of an agreement. Yeah, yeah.
Theatrics,
which
yeah?
suggests to me that, you know, there's somewhat overheated speculation in some quarters that this is the sort of thing that could lead to the end of the government was misplaced. It's just a signal that, you know, budgets are always to a certain degree in an exercise in political communication. It's how the government expresses its priorities and its policies to the voters in a way that the voters sit up and take notice, because budget time is one of the few times of the year actually when everybody is switched on to what politicians are saying. And I think that is even more so the case this year as you count down to an election.
Okay, so in the short answer to my question is yes, it is a zombie government with just one job to do. Okay, in your opinion, Aisling, me and you picked on this theme, the crumbling coalition, five rifts that are emerging as the clock ticks. This is Claire Scott in the Sunday Times.
Yes, Brendan. there's plenty of pieces about it in today's paper, but like I think there's obviously a rift in the, and I suppose a lot of it in that particular article was around who's taken credit for different positive things that have been brought in. But equally, I thought of note was the negative things that are being rolled back on. Daniel Murray had a very good piece in the Business Post, and everything, me as an employer, that had me shaking in my boots. You know, you have your pensions auto enrolment, you have an increase in the minimum wage, you have an increase in the statutory sick pay, an increase in employers' PRSI. They've all seemed to be, they're being paused and potentially they're being rolled back on, especially the pensions enrolment. This has been going on for a long time, this pensions enrolment, and they keep stalling
and
stalling.
It was such a big hoo-ha then, the announcement that it was finally happening and everything.
Yeah, and they're now talking about pausing it again. And like an interesting thing as well is like in that particular article, they made reference to like that they don't have the infrastructure in place to even to like process it at an administrative level. And I'm involved in a working group. I was invited by the Department of Ag about encouraging women into farming. And we would have seen something similar in terms of TAMS grants that were announced for women farmers. And these were announced 18 like
explain
you know applications
what they are.
So it's TAMS grants, we'll say it's you know for infrastructure, it's for you know more environmentally friendly farming equipment, health and safety measures, and there's a 60% grant where women are applying for those, women farmers. So it's to try and encourage from a policy perspective more women farmers, but those applications have been lodged by the women farmers. They've been processed. They haven't been processed. They've just been sitting there. So like women are waiting to make these investments. But the justification they've come back recently is that it's just the infrastructure isn't there to be able to process those claims. So they get the announcement, they get the buzz, they get the publicity from it. But like then on the ground, actually put it into place is a whole different. I think there's a lack of communication between making these grandiose announcements and actually then fulfilling those things on the ground. We see it with the RZLT. Like it's for ages, there's two big things that farmers want.
This was the zone land.
Yeah,
the zone land.
Like farmers have been like they've been lobbying really, really strongly about this. Like it's basically that actively farmed land is getting hit with a 3% tax.
How much of it? How many farmers is that really affecting?
There's a good number of farmers.
Like what?
I don't know the specific.
I've heard a few hundred is one figure somebody's mentioned or fewer.
Yeah, but the impact that it's having on farms, the same as the nitrates regulations.
And I know now there were some issues with people not being allowed to unzone their land.
Yes.
But they were allowed to, they have had 2 or 3 years to dezone their land for housing if they want it.
Yeah, but they have to make individual submissions to the local authorities. And like, I've had people coming to me and, you know, farmers, like, they've had to go to the expense of, like, if they're getting legal advice or if they're getting accountancy advice. And like, there's, you know, in terms of trying to plan for the future, this was an easy fix for them to exempt farmers that are actively farming the land. And they've been lobbied for that for a very long time. And it's only like a switch of a, like
when
a light
wanted,
switch.
When they wanted
they were,
to do
they
it
were
then.
Able yeah. to do it, you know.
Now, can I just ask you one other question about it, though, given that you're at the coalface and you've obviously been dealing with farmers who are in this position. Are there some farmers as well who are being cute here and who are thinking, well, I'm farming the land right now, but it's no harm that it's zoned for housing at some point, like, that I keep that zoning. And should presumably that land is worth multiples of what it would be as farming land then if they ultimately decide to sell it.
I don't necessarily, I wouldn't agree with that argument, because like if farmers are being offered obscene money in order to sell their land, if there is development potential with it,
they'd have taken it
more than
now.
Likely they'll yeah. take your arm okay. off, because like because that is what is curtailing farmers at the moment, is the land availability, and with nitrates and with stocking densities, etc., that if they can like restructure, because there's reliefs there for restructuring. So if you sell a little bit of land and buy a bigger bit of land, or if you can consolidate your holdings, from a policy perspective, there's great tax breaks there. So it'd be a no-brainer to sell the land to be able to buy other land.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Graham, you picked that story as well in the Sunday Times, the crumbling coalition.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the tensions are around getting credit for various things. You know, Radhika Gorman wants credit for the childcare reductions in cost. And he also probably wants a more joined up government in terms of asylum seeker housing. And so you see that what's behind it is something which Aisling was talking about in relation to farmers. And we see for a lot of people on the average industrial wage or below, is that all of this emphasis on one-off payments, on one-off cuts, really puts the onus on people to cobble together their income from a lot of different little funds and to apply for things. And it's very onerous for the average working person. So what we would like to see is something which has been called for by other parts of the coalition, which is some more joined up budgetary thinking, more investment into systems and to have the systems provide the services without you having to go and look and see, oh, I'm up 150 euro on energy, but I'm down 150 euro on childcare.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. We're dealing with what you might call a legacy situation. So yeah. It we're gets a brick of Lego added on here and a brick taken off there, and there's no
It's the legacy of the Irish government not wanting to spend money, which has been true since the foundation of the state. And like, it's really hard on providers. Like the childcare story at the head of the Mail, on the headline for the Mail was, I mean, it's maybe not that provider, but it's very hard on providers generally to make the core funding, the subsidies work.
Okay. Suzanne, that brings us on to a piece in the Business Post written by Taoiseach and amateur columnist at times, Simon Harris, about the need for a minister for infrastructure. You picked that.
I did. I mean, just to pick up on one of your lines from earlier on, there's a quote, I can't think who it's from, but it is, we know exactly what we need to do, we just don't know how to do it and then get re-elected. So that is
Jean-Claude Juncker.
There we go.
We all know what to do, we just don't know how to get re-elected afterwards. But,
And that is the difficulty in this space. I thought this piece was really, really interesting. We would absolutely echo the need for planning. He is correct.
When you say we, you're talking Social Justice Ireland? I mean,
definitely we as Social Justice Ireland, but I think we as citizens of the nation as well, really need to be looking at, our country is changing. It's changing rapidly. We are aging. Our birth rates at the moment are quite high across Europe, but they are falling. How we do things is changing. We have a green transition coming. We have a digital transition coming. That needs to be managed and planned for. So I think
what Graham was saying there then about this system that keeps getting bits added on and it's all kind of piecemeal across the way. If we add in a Department of Infrastructure into the already kind of... You know, they already kind of
just another
complex system.
Yeah,
is it just going to be more more managers, basically, like?
I mean, at the moment, I suppose what a lot of policy people would look for is, you know, be thrilled when something goes into the Department of An Taoiseach, because that has teeth. So like the child poverty and wellbeing, you know, that went into the Department of An Taoiseach because there's accountability there. But I definitely take the point, as you said, about, you know, something is, there's sometimes there's a lack of policy coherence. We see that the budget is upon us now very, very soon. And what we'll see is maybe an increase to a core social welfare rate. But the other departments then don't automatically increase their threshold. So social housing, medical card, all of these things, there isn't a joined up process across government departments. I mean, the fact that you can come out of Dublin Airport, we are a capital city, we operate on a worldwide basis, and there's no train link or tram link or anything into the city centre.
We're building one.
We've been building one since, what was it, since I don't know, since
this is 25 years
since Oasis last played.
But in their heyday, probably.
You know, I think he makes a very valid point here, which is that he doesn't see this proposal as a criticism of Ireland's public service or administration. And the recent piece from the Housing Commission, you know, massive piece of work from the Housing Commission, also really focused in on that. This is not about, as you said, blaming somebody or giving somebody credit for something, but looking forward and saying, where do we see ourselves as a country in 2050 when Oasis reunite again for the next time?
And I suppose, Pat, when you think about it, we came up with these government departments. I mean, obviously they've changed as the years have gone on, but they're not they don't change as rapidly as the world changes. Sure, they don't. Like, most organisations are restructuring every few years at this stage to look at a different world and different challenges and everything. So that's one. That it probably is a good idea now and again to throw everything up in the air and go, okay, what are the departments? Secondly, is he planning, do you think, on, is this going to come in before an election, or is this a kind of a next government promise?
No, this will be, I think, part of the Fine Gael manifesto, and all parties, as part of their preparations for the elections, are drawing up manifestos. Sinn Féin is going to launch its housing plans tomorrow. So that's the sort of phase in the electoral calendar we're into. Simon Harris spoken about this. I think he gave a speech about it at the McGill Summer School over the in July, and he spoke about it in an interview he did with us in the Irish Times as well. So this is nailed down part of the Fine Gael manifesto.
It's kind of a big idea thing.
Part of a big idea.
Aisling, you picked it as well. You like it coming from a rural Ireland perspective.
I actually thought it was very well written, and he hits all the buzzwords. Like, he talks about, like, you know, I was laughing when I read this about the Cork to Limerick road, which we're desperately in need of. But then he adds on, we'll prove once and for all that all roads don't lead to Dublin. He makes reference to technology, floating wind farms, harnessing power of the Atlantic. But I suppose it's important to say that this paragraph kind of explains that roads are done by the Department of Transport, houses by the Department of Housing, hospitals by the Department of Health, and schools by the Department of Education, and so on. So what he's talking is about putting that all under one umbrella. And I think there's good rationale to what he's proposing.
And schools is almost a freelance thing at this stage, isn't it? Like, you've local communities, parents coming together to educate together, and then applying for money and everything. Like, it's kind of almost like a freelance system. Graham, you're nodding there.
Yeah, well, I had personal experience of this because I was until recently the chair of the board of management of a primary school.
Yeah.
And we were looking for a very large extension, and it was up to random volunteers like me to sort of shepherd that through with the principal, who did the vast majority of the work. But, you know, to individually apply and relate through the Department of Education to see where we are, to hire, or if they, you know, through a complex process, get our own architects and everything. And obviously that's very cumbersome, but it's also, I'm not at all qualified to do this. And elsewhere in the papers, you see Simon Harris himself as a constituency TD pushing Norma Foley on the progress of a individual school building in Greystones. So it's, I mean, that's how it works. And it's really not joined up in the education.
Yeah, I'm not sure that changes with the Department of Infrastructure, though. It just means that you won't be going to the Department of Education, or more likely you will be going to the Department of Education, which then goes to the Department of Infrastructure. I mean, the roads question is a good example, because, you know, back 25 years ago when Oasis and the rest of us were in our heyday, you know, roads budgets were typically, or roads projects were typically overshooting their budgets massively. Then the Department of Transport, or its forerunner, actually got to grips with it, and it now does roads
we're
predictably
quite successful
for
at roads now,
about,
aren't we?
I think, yeah. I think the figure is about 10 million per kilometre.
I've
That's
heard of roads like coming in not on time, but ahead of time, yeah, and under budget,
yeah,
as well.
No, we're quite good at that now. And that, I suppose, the danger of instituting a new department is that sort of expertise, which exists in some departments, clearly not in all of them.
Yeah, okay, okay.
Goes missing.
It's going to be a department of everything, though, isn't it? It'll be Roderick O'Gorman or some poor patsy put in there. And like, infrastructure is going to be such a huge thing over the next phase. Okay, moving on to other shape throwing then. Suzanne, Graham, actually, we start with you, and the front of the Sunday Times, Sinn Féin vows to rip up system on house building.
Yeah, that's a really interesting contrast to Simon Harris's sort of op-ed, which is, you know, to decentralize in a way the construction of houses, to move the powers from the Land Development Agency to the local authorities. Now, the local authorities have had some success in the past, but they're so underpowered in our system, mm-hmm, that you wonder whether it's going to be able to do the things that Sinn Féin wants it to do.
We've just been talking about that we need to centralize things into a Department of Infrastructure, and now we want to have every local council in the country, which are... A lot of them, you know, there are professional people working in there. They also have the influence of what you might call enthusiastic amateurs and the former local councillors. And we want to put house building out to that network of people.
I mean, it's going to be a stark contrast between the two parties' offerings in the coming election. But yes, you wonder whether the capacity's there in county councils or in the various Dublin councils.
Yeah, there is a feeling the expertise is not there.
The land
bank,
which the LDA has, is huge, and transferring that to the local councils is probably complicated.
They seem to be talking about that the land part of things would be left with the LDA, that it would be a kind of a land agency and would have CPO as well. And then on that, Suzanne, tell me about this piece in the Business Post on Sinn Féin housing. Banks fear being caught in crossfire of coalition. Actually, Pat, would you outline it to us first, and then, Suzanne, I'll get your take on it.
So as part of the Sinn Féin plan for affordable housing, one of their ideas is that the state supplies the land, and that the houses you will own, you know, your affordable house, which will cost between 250,000 and 300,000, are the figures that they previously supplied. We'll see what they come up with when they launch a policy tomorrow. But you will own your house. You can do what you want to your house. You can leave your house to your children. But the state will continue to own the land.
And if you want to sell your house under this, you need to sell it to an approved person at an approved price, don't you? So it stays within affordable housing.
And what this Business Post story is about is Darragh O'Brien, the housing minister, asking the banks, will you or will you not give mortgages for these sort of house purchases and house transactions? And so I think what you're saying is, even before the Sinn Féin housing document is out, and we know from lots of polling, including today, that housing remains one of the top issues and will be at the very centre of the electoral debate when it comes. So I think you're seeing a bit of rolling of the pitch or a bit.
And the government wants to enlist Brian Hayes, former Fine Gael TD, to wade into this on behalf of the banks.
Representative, head of the bankers' representative body.
So, Suzanne Rogers, you picked this piece as well. What do you think about that?
I think what really struck me about this particular piece was the fact that the banks have put mortgages on lots of different properties over the decades. We had 110% mortgages. They were happy to lend on that. They were happy to insist on full payment on mortgages that had property pyrite properties and mica properties. I mean, they couldn't be resold, and yet the banks insisted upon full repayment of that. We also have mortgages that were being lent to people up until they were in their 80s. So this thing of putting it back on the banks to go, ooh, I don't know now, can you really?
This looks a bit risky to us.
I mean, that was the bit that I have this.
Of course, the banks have sense these days now. Well, like it's been enforced on them a bit more.
But this the enforcement word really, as opposed to that they got sense, I think is really, really the space for this. And like this thing is that the banks have not been able to guarantee that they will lend mortgages under this proposed new scheme, generating major concerns and uncertainty. And that's the bit I would question, which is that they have to date had some highly questionable mortgages over the decades. So I don't see, to me, this is a, you know, no offence to the journalist, but I do think it's a little bit of a non-story in the sense, if that is the question we're asking is, oh, can banks possibly lend?
If the banks actually said, no, we won't lend mortgages, that completely undermines the Sinn Féin policy.
I can't see how they could even do it. If you don't own the land and if there's restrictions on your ability to sell it on, like working on that site, like we do a lot of like mortgages, either residential or commercial. And like the amount of I's and T's that need to be crossed, like we're doing, if we're doing certificates of title or if we're acting like as for residential mortgages, the same solicitor can act for the bank and also for the borrower, but they have to give an undertaking so that basically if they need to rely on the house to sell it, if the loan is not being repaid, they need to have good title. And if they don't have good title, so they need to be able to go and sell that if the loan is repaid. So if the people don't own the land, how are they going to be able to sell it on? It's going to be subject to so many T's and C's. I would see the banks running a mile from something like that.
Really?
Absolutely running a mile. It's not bankable.
There is also the possibility, of course, that the banks under the current government might say, oh, no, we couldn't deal with a proposal like that. And in the event of there being a Sinn Féin government, the banks might take a different view, of course.
Yeah, OK. The budget then is all around us today again. Aisling, you mentioned the auto-enrolment stuff earlier, planned the delay planned for the 2025 budget package. There's also bits and pieces around about, and there have been for weeks now, but like from as a tax expert, could you give us some clarity on what we might expect and how much it might be worth to us? Like there's talk of a 0.5% USC cut today and then the bans we've heard are going up and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah. It kind of goes back to even the poll, like they were talking about, you know, you look at like tax cuts or you look at, is it investment in public spending? And the poll was suggesting that there would be a preference, 57% investment in public spending and 40% would be tax cuts, 3% don't know. So on the tax cut sides, I suppose, like the stuff is leaked way in advance. Like in the papers as well, there was talks about, you know, they're still kind of trying to figure out what is it that the electorate like or want. But from a tax point of view, they're talking about increases in the tax band. So at the moment, a single person can earn up to 42,000 and pay tax at the standard rate. If they go above that, it's 40% tax. If you have, we'll say, a couple both working, they can earn up to nearly 84,000, double it basically, before they go into the high tax. And I suppose there's loads of research shows that it's quite progressive. It's in Ireland, it's pretty fair how the tax system works. Those that are the richest pay the most tax, and it's a pretty fair system. What they're talking about is maybe like, and they do progressively increase it. Like the single rate band was 42 this year, it was 40 last year, it was 36.8. So it's been increased in line with inflation. On the USC, like the USC, they promised to abolish it. It was brought in as an emergency tax. Like taxpayers just really despise it. They do not like it because it's charged on like anything. Generally, it's not in social welfare, but anything over 13 grand, you pay USC and it increases on the first 12 grand, you pay 0.5. And then when you earn up to 44, when you're on the next 44,000, it's 4%. And then the balance goes to 8%. So it's quite punitive. So what they're talking about is reducing that from 4% to 3.5%. So like if you talk, that's 0.5% change. If you calculate that on about 40 grand's worth, it's the difference about 221 euros.
OK.
We're not going to feel it hugely in our pockets. But I suppose just like on that, I suppose, you know, even I was looking, reading about, you know, from as a parent, I have four young kids. I had a little one that started junior infants this week and another one started Montessori and I have two others in primary school.
You had a cheap week, did you?
Very cheap week. We had our free books. It was more hassle. Like not having to get the books was manna from heaven. And then like this,
did that make a big difference?
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. And like the other thing is like, you know, I was thinking about it, like, you know, this kind of, there's like peer pressure to go out and buy new bags and new shoes and new, you know, lunch boxes. Like, it's just nonsense. You know, like, what's wrong with the ones last year? So we had this, mine are young enough that I can have that conversation with them. Mm. Now they upcycle for their cool camp bags. So on the other two got the old bags. But like at the same time, like you're looking at the things that are brought in. These are the things that, for, you know, to try and appease parents and win votes, free books, you know, free meals, GP cards for under eights. Grant, yeah, I'm not going to give him back. But at the same time, if, God forbid, if I had an emergency in the morning, I had to bring my child into the regional in Limerick, am I, you know, would I be confident that they're going to get good care? Absolutely not. So, like, there's things like that that, like, I just think they are kind of focusing on the low-hanging fruit. Of course, there's an election coming up. But, like, I would, you know, childcare, there's no childcare providers. They're talking about tax cuts, you know, services for mental health, like social media, and, you know, having some, you know, legislation there in order to try and protect kids and
yeah,
things they're exposed of. That's a whole new thing. But things like that, they're, as a parent, they're more important to me than the free books and the free meals.
But will it be manna from heaven as well? The second childcare subsidy increase happens tomorrow, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's limited. You know, it's for people that have kids in you know, in childcare with a registered childcare provider. There's an awful lot of people that don't.
But
won't get
people,
the benefit of
a
it.
A lot of people, I'm past that now, but colleagues of mine who got their first invoices when they brought their kids back to creches during the week all found that they were, you know, 200 or 300 euros a month going to be better off because of
the
thing
that's
kicking in
now.
You know?
So people are not feeling that.
Yeah, my colleague texted me, yep,
for
time
real.
For an election.
Right now, yeah, okay. All right, let's take a break. Aisling Meehan, Graham Finlay, Pat Leahy and Suzanne Rogers staying with us. Welcome back. Aisling Meehan, Graham Finlay, Pat Leahy and Suzanne Rogers still with us. Guys, just one more little bit of politics on the shiny side of things. Graham, you picked this. There's actually two pieces today about celebrity candidates, but you picked David Davenport's piece in the Sunday Independent. A little bit more edgy, particularly on George Lee, I would have said. So what's he saying?
Well, to my shame, he's saying that, look, celebrity candidates have historically not really worked. And he uses George Lee as an example. And I don't want to pick on George Lee either.
No, but I think DDP has done enough of that for everyone.
There is, like, and I've actually, to my shame, sort of written about celebrity politics in a global context. And my article on Madonna.
So give us a non-parochial view.
Is one of my most cited articles. But, you know, celebrities, I mean, what I like about Irish politics is it's so local. You have terrific access to your politicians, and you have terrific access to your celebrities, right? You know, you feel like you know the people on RTE who then run for various political jobs, run for office. Like Kieran Mullooly, he makes the point, you know, is very involved in like local community development in that area, like his community, which is going to give him a better place than, say, someone who's just coming in because they think they're going to be minister as soon as they arrive, right? So what we see internationally, so I like to think our celebrities are fairly humble, but what we see internationally is celebrities, it's very much part of their brand. Like Madonna was going into Malawi, adopting children, but also engaging in a very Madonna-centric form of development where she had her like oxygen facialist as sort of an advisor on healthcare and things like that.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, it was...
Harry and Meghan politics, basically.
It is. I mean, so celebrities, I mean, they are their brand. That's where the value is. And it tends to lead to really bad development projects.
Okay. Pat,
Madonna never got elected in Sligo Leitrim.
Yeah.
I mean, parties love celebrity candidates, and they've quite a decent track record at getting elected. Now, there's lots of examples, and DDP cites some of them of people who were celebrities and didn't get elected. But it gives you the edge because voters know who you are.
GAA guys didn't get elected.
True. Yes. Yeah. But a lot of them have gotten elected, and it's your celebrity status doesn't get you elected.
Jack Lynch, we bless ourselves, original celebrity candidate, wasn't he?
Yeah. It doesn't get you elected, but it gets you a hearing from voters, gets you recognition. There was a whole bunch of them in the local and European elections who got elected. So, you know, these pieces today, and Shane Coleman is another piece as well, and they're both of them are taking the same the same example from George Lee, who was unveiled at the same time as a candidate, as a little-known senator at that time from Dublin Central called Pascal Donoghue, who went on. And if you had I think Shane Coleman makes the point that if you were to take a bet on who was going to be Minister for Finance at that press conference, very few people would have bet on Pascal Donoghue ahead of George Lee, but so it came to pass. The ultimate celebrity candidate is, of course, Donald Trump, and you know, he's been good at getting elected as well.
Yeah, but it's led to poor development projects, I think Graham would say, if we can call it that. Suzanne, are you against this kind of thing?
Just when you're talking about, you know, who gets elected and where, like, Irish politics is so centralised. According to, like, there's a Council of Europe report there not too long ago, we're one of the most centralised countries in Europe in terms of where power actually lies.
So local government has no power,
and a
right.
University of Lausanne in their local authority index, we're on a par with Russia in terms of how much powers local authorities actually have, which feeds back into the housing piece. We're extremely centralised. So I think that also plays a part in who goes for election and where they go for election. And if you want to actually make change, where you need to position yourself, I think is also part of that conversation.
Okay. What do you think, Ashley?
Yeah, I think a mix is good. Like, at the end of the day, it all comes down to, like, their ability and their ability and their, you know, being able to communicate and to be able to connect with the voters. So I'm all for some celebrities. I think it's healthy, it's good.
I'd say possibly more in rural Ireland than possibly in Dublin. People are maybe less cynical about that kind of thing. Listen, just to bring you some good breaking news now from the Paralympics in Paris. So since we came on air, the Irish paracyclists have been in action, and following their heat, Katie George Dunleavy and her pilot Eve McChrystal are now guaranteed either gold or silver in the B 3000m individual pursuit, and that their final takes place at 1:41 p.m. this afternoon. So that's a second medal guaranteed now for Team Ireland in the bag. So well done to them. Graham, we have breaking news this morning from the Middle East, breaking news every morning, I suppose, but we've seen 6 hostages tragically found dead. What's your read on where we're at?
Well, obviously, it's an awful, awful thing to hear about. And again, not getting into the politics of the two sides or, you know, what each one is guilty of, because I think when you see this kind of awful event in people's lives, but also the sheer magnitude of the destruction and death we're seeing in Gaza and in the West Bank now, that, you know, you have to sort of just acknowledge how awful it is. And then we can look at Israeli politics, because what's been really striking about this is it has highlighted, if it needed highlighting, how the priorities of the Israeli government have not been to rescue the hostages, but have been to destroy Gaza and to attack Hamas. And so what we're seeing is Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel, apologize.
People would argue as well that all Hamas had to do was hand back the hostages and it would all end.
That is what they're saying, although if Hamas hands back... Again, I'm not here to defend Hamas.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. We're not demanding anyone take sides here.
If they hand back the hostages, obviously they have no negotiating power whatsoever. And then Israel shows no sign of committing to a ceasefire, of halting its attacks. Its attacks have been even more severe in recent weeks. So while it's hard to figure out what happened, because it's hard to figure out who to believe, what's really striking is Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel, apologized to the families of the hostages who had been killed because they'd failed to get them out. And the Hostage Families Representative Association is talking about shutting down Israel to highlight the fact that the priority is not rescuing the hostages. And they squarely put the blame on Netanyahu, who's been under pressure on this front for a long time.
And does that feel like it's building as well, that opinion within Israel and that anti-Netanyahu feel?
It's very tricky. It has been building. It's been there since the beginning, but it's been building as the months go on without any marked success in rescuing hostages, with Israeli defense forces killing by mistake hostages, which they were actually on the brink of rescuing, with the failure of any action and Netanyahu's clinging to power with a bunch of very, very far-right ministers whose priority is not the hostages at all. You know, it's been building. It's led to very large demonstrations. And it's pretty much the only thing which is working against the war in Israel, because the Israeli public is not seeing what we're seeing in terms of the destruction in Gaza, of the horrible videos which we're all bombarded with on social media every day. They're not seeing it. It's not being reported on. You know, Haaretz and various other news organizations and rights groups like B'Tselem are highlighting these things. But it's a very much a minority view. And if you watch television in Israel, I'm told, you will not see any coverage beyond that of funerals of Israeli soldiers who have lost their lives.
And can I ask you one related question then? So, I mean, some glimmer of hope
kind of, is that there are these brief pauses to allow for what sounds like a very, very challenging polio vaccination campaign. You have a certain kind of knowledge around polio and spread of polio
A while ago, I was looking at polio as sort of the ultimate example of a development effort which everyone wants to succeed. We were so close to eliminating it. There were only a few cases in Nigeria. There were some cases in Afghanistan. There were people, and in fact,
and just to explain, if you eliminate polio, if there's no polio case in the world, it's possibly gone then.
Yeah, it could be like smallpox.
You get to zero.
Now
yeah?
It's complicated by the fact that we're using oral polio vaccine, which has to be administered twice, once and then another 4 weeks later to very, very small children, but to anybody can take it. It has to be kept cold, so you need cold chain storage in an area like Gaza where everything is being destroyed, where the patients don't have access to clean water and food, let alone to, you know, refrigeration. And but, you know, the Taliban and the NATO were working together about polio vaccination in Afghanistan.
Okay.
Is that much of a threat to people? And I think that's probably behind Israel.
So everyone, it's something everyone can
But it's
get
going
on
to be incredibly challenging given the complete destruction of infrastructure in Gaza.
Okay. And look, I'm conscious that having talked about that, it almost makes things and other things feel slightly trivial, but you know, first world problems and all that. But we think back to our own children and young people here who have, you know, again, different challenges. But one thing that did focus a lot of people on it this past week, Aisling, was the story of Kirsty Allsopp sending off her 15-year-old son to go into railing, and it did kick off a huge debate about parenting, didn't it?
Yeah, it does, and I suppose it's trying to find the balance between, I suppose, you know, whose responsibility it is, and like the, you know, even, you know, when you talk about the smartphones, and there's a lot in the papers this week about the ban on the smartphones, and they're talking about, like, they've called for a ban on smartphones for under 16s. And it's a hard one because, like you're saying, is it a school problem or is it a state problem or is it a parent's problem or is it a mixture of all three? And then can it fall between three different stools? So
does it sound like, because you will allude there to the and there's a poll today in the Sunday Independent where it's basically, and I think people might be surprised at this, it's kind of 2-1 of people who agree with the IMO that children under 16 should not have phones, and 2-1 agree with Simon Donnelly that in this poll that under 16 should not have access to social media. So it seemed, but then if you go out there, all the kids under 16 have phones, they all have access to social media. But clearly, people wish somebody would help them and do something about it.
I agree. And like the thing is, like, who was polled? Probably the parents and the adults were polled. And like, interestingly, there was a very interesting article. And I'm telling Simon Harris would do well to try and get this girl on board. Eleanor Green wrote a piece for the Sunday Independent. Basically, teens like me love the freedom phones gives us. And she made really, really good points about, like, you know, about security. And like, she was just, it was really balanced. Like she highlighted all the things that, like, we don't like about phones, but equally she highlighted all the good things about phones. And even it made me kind of sick, because initially, like, I'm anti-phones for kids. Like, I just think, you know, I think a contributor last week to your programme likened them to cigarettes. And I think people will look back at it in time. But then it's like everything is age appropriate. So, like, yes, you know, I think there has to be.
So do you have phones in the house yet? No.
No, my eldest is 7. So, no. Yeah. So, like, I would agree, like, primary school, like, they shouldn't be allowed. And in our local primary school, it's kind of a pact that that kids don't have phones. But when it comes to secondary school, they gradually bring it in. But, like, equally, I met a group of friends from college there recently, and we were all sitting around, and none of them allowed their kids to watch YouTube. And I was horrified. I was like, oh my God, I wasn't even aware of this, that this was a bad thing that they were doing.
A new danger. Yeah.
I seriously, like, my kids watch YouTube, and like, we have whatever restrictions, but
and
even
YouTube kids, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, YouTube,
is
but
the,
even at that, like, apparently,
appropriate.
Yeah, they, like, were saying, no, that there's behavioural issues. So, it's you know, yeah, like, and the other side of it is, like, with kids, you know, I'm very aware as well, you know, you have to, like, resilience is huge. So you have to learn, you have to teach kids, you have to give them their heads, you have to give them a bit of space and freedom and let them make up their own mind, because when they go out into the big bad world...
Send them off into rail and death.
But it, when they go out into the big bad world, like, it depends on the kid as well. Like, I've, like, my eldest one, I'd let him into rail in the morning. My third one, not a hope. You know, it depends on the kids, you know, like, whether, like, the sensible one and the, you know, it's... So I think you had, there is a balance to be struck, but I do think that parents need to, you know, they need to man up, for want of a better phrase, and, you know, take a bit of responsibility. It comes back to the healthy, eating ad that's on. I find that so, there's a healthy eating ad, and basically it's like, you know, they've, in the background, the parent is doing the shopping. It's like, oh, put in the treats. And then it really resonated with me. It's like, at the end of the day, like, I have this joke with my parents, who's like, who's the parent and who's the child? With my husband, sorry. Because, like, you know, the kid is, and you know, is arguing with you about something. But, like, at the end of the day, you have to make the hard choice about what's appropriate.
We'll talk again. We'll talk again in 5 years' time. I keep going into secondary school. And you're manning up and telling them they're not getting a phone.
Although my dad says I'm training up a great generation of barristers, because they'd argue.
Argue
back with me. So
yeah, I have a few human rights lawyers in my house as well. Pat, it's an interesting one. So we should just say, this poll in the Sunday Independent, text-based poll conducted on Friday and Saturday among 1,423 people, the margin of error 2.7, and the comparisons with last month's text poll. But this is well beyond any margin of error. Stephen Donnelly and the IMO have identified something here, clearly, that there is massive support for, whether people believe it'll happen or not. But clearly,
well, yeah, we're back to where we
in
started.
An ideal world or something, would like it to happen notionally.
I think we're back to where we started, talking about the impending election. Micheál Martin raised this in his Ardèche speech earlier this year, when he said that they would ban smartphones in schools. And, you know, again, as a parent, it seems to me that that would be an extremely popular move from the point of view of parents. Now, a lot of schools have sort of bans in place as it is, but...
But leadership is helpful, probably, is it? Like, it's helpful if...
I would have thought so, And I think the current proposal is that there simply be a circular from the Minister for Education saying smartphones should be banned in schools. Now, look, if schools don't implement that, then so be it. But I think it strengthens the hand.
It gives everyone cover to do
it. Yes, it does.
And I'd say parents would love cover to do it as well. You know, there's an interesting piece of research, Suzanne. I won't get the numbers right on this, but basically they asked students, I think third level students, right, how much would it take for you to give up your social media for a month? And they would need to have been paid to give up their social media for a month, right? How much would it take for everyone to give up social media for a month? They were willing to pay for everyone to be off it, right? So the point being, the kids themselves, if nobody else had a phone, they'd prefer it. But because everyone else have a phone, they need to have one as well. That's kind of it, isn't it?
Oh, it's that connection that it gives you. And I don't think it's just a young person problem. Like, as a proud Gen Xer, you know, adults, like, that freaks me out when I see adults on their phones ignoring their children. So they won't allow their small kid anywhere near the phone, but they're busy on their phone not talking to their kid. And I'm kind of
reading stuff about how terrible the phones are for kids.
They're answering the WhatsApp groups.
It's exactly that. You know, people who won't allow their kids to watch TV, but then spend hours watching, you know, questionable whatever, you know. But there was moral panic over children reading at one stage, you know, children having access to paperback books and children reading, and that their posture, their posture was going to be destroyed because they were sitting reading. So we need to be very careful about, like, video nasties, video games, all of these things. This is about a conversation about, these are tools. We all love our phones. I can't imagine anybody here wanting to go without their phones. They are necessary for us to navigate in the digital world that we live in. You're absolutely right. Your child needs to navigate that space same as they do real space. Who they meet online needs the same sort of rules as who they meet in real life. We need to be providing the tools and having... I have a teenage son. You have to have real conversations about, what are you watching? Because you're a fool to think that there's not questionable content.
And do you still feel the channels of communication are open, and that you know what's going on with him in terms of his phone?
Yeah. I mean, did any parent ever know where their teenage was when he was off interrailing at the age of 15 anyway? You know what I mean? I kind of think like that is, that teenage space is where you create who you are as an adult, yeah, and who you, yeah, want to be as an adult and where you align yourself.
So you have
yourself
to give them the space.
You have to
that
give them the space. And then the safety net to come back and go, "Mom, I've really messed up." You know what I mean? That there is a security there, there's a resilience there that we can, you know, if there's a problem, we can fix it. But I just think that they're not going away. We really need to be just aware. As you said, there is an age growth. You know, there was one thing I read, again, I saw the headline where like tiny little kids had seen questionable content online, you know, kind of 5 and 6 year old children had seen questionable content online. So there's a real question about keeping people safe.
But there's also a question of regulation, because if there's one thing that we know about the internet companies and social media companies is that they will not do this unless they are forced to do it by regulation. They will not do it off their own accord.
Yeah, okay. Aisling Meehan, Graham Finlay, Pat Leahy and Suzanne Rogers are staying with us. I need to take another break. Welcome back. Our panel is still here. Aisling Meehan, Graham Finlay, Pat Leahy and Suzanne Rogers. And Suzanne Rogers, you picked something not from today's papers, just a little nugget from The Guardian about the American presidential election.
This made me smile in a sad way. It was looking at the recent interview with the presidential hopefuls, and the question they were both asked was, if you are elected, what would you do on day one? And people weren't very impressed with Kamala's answer, which was one of her highest priorities is to do what we can to support the middle class. But then they contrast that with that Trump was asked the same question about day one, and he said he would be a dictator. So there's that.
Yeah, okay. Graham, it does feel as if the honeymoon is over for Kamala and indeed for Coach Walz, isn't it? And a little bit more hard questions being asked now.
I mean, it was inevitable that they couldn't keep up the momentum that was coming out of the convention forever, and we'll see how it goes. Sure, they should be asked hard questions, and they will be. What's really striking is how little policy matters in this election. This is a trend we've seen for a long time, but it's really become heightened. So you can ask them about tax cuts and so forth, but they're actually selling their stories and their backgrounds, for lack of a better word. And that is still working for them compared to Trump and J.D. Vance, because we know so much about them. And it seems like J.D. Vance in particular provides sort of fuel for that momentum on the Harris-Walz side almost every day with some kind of gaffe. And in a policy-free environment, that is where things are going. And so
okay, the polls are looking that way into the election then, that this momentum of it being kind of people's gut feelings about people, I like the cut of that person's jib or not, is
That's what's going to be decisive. Yeah. I mean, I think the one issue which they really are foregrounding on Harris-Walz's side is union membership and union activism, which is a bit of a new thing for the Democratic Party and for American politics. But that could be incredibly important for them in certain key states like Nevada and Michigan.
Okay. And listen, then, the having had a week of, like, Aisling, just this kind of over-the-top positive coverage for Oasis, the story did a sharp handbrake turn yesterday. There's a couple of stories there. You picked out one in the Business Post. It's never been easy to buy concert tickets, insists a concert veteran.
Yeah, there was a piece about Donald McNamee, and he was talking to Tommy Higgins, who was talking about 1990.
He's a former executive vice president of Ticketmaster in Europe, yeah.
He was talking about back in 96, he estimated 20,000 people baying for a ticket on HMV in Grafton Street. And he said, like, there was two shows and there was probably only about 12,000 tickets available for the whole country. So, you know, there was no more than 3,000 or 4,000 tickets in Grafton Street on that day. So he was just making, you know, people say they have it hard now. They're sitting in front of a computer for an hour or two. But like going back to, I think you mentioned earlier, like first world problems really is. But like equally, I was just thinking back. It was like, you know, it was like the All-Ireland tickets for us, you know, being a Clare person and married to a Cork man. I would have given my right arm for it. But like eventually, I think you do, you know, we got one, but like we got two tickets. But the only thing I would say, so I kind of like my view on it is like, you know, it's a first world problem not being able to get a ticket.
Yeah, but Suzanne, you looked at this as well. The difference between what Tommy Higgins is talking about back then was the tickets had a price.
there was a price on a ticket. And we are now entering into what I think people obviously didn't notice that this has been happening, but it has. And it's the norm in America now. Any big act, there really is no ticket price anymore. They're just trying to get whatever they can bear. So the same ticket that was like less than 100 quid on Friday, once they saw there's a market here, those same tickets, no add-ons, were 400 quid by Saturday.
I mean, there's your market right there. I mean, that's your market system. But it's exactly that. Like, I have tickets at home, handwritten tickets that you bought. You went into the record shop and they wrote in. So they had a book of the SFX tickets and they wrote in the date and the artist and then €6.50. And as somebody who was in the Tivoli in 94, a half empty Tivoli, I might add, in 94. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that somebody would have €1,000 to buy two tickets for a gig as well. I just think is, as you said, that's a real first world problem.
Yeah, I think a lot of people ended up spending more than they intended thinking I came in here thinking I was going to, and suddenly caught up in
dynamic
the moment.
Pricing,
but look, that is dynamic pricing, and that is probably the future of all the big acts coming. Okay, thanks very much to my panel today, Aisling Meehan, Graham Finlay, Pat Leahy and Suzanne Rogers. And now it's just coming up to 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.